Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about podcast on gratitude. Now, I'm just trying to, unfortunately, make up for some lost time and actually put in a few more podcasts, partly because I believe that I've sort of gone off them a bit too soon and tried to delve into actually writing up some structured ideas. And there's no problem with that. It's that I've sort of just realised that there's several complexities in actually doing complex ideas. One is that I actually don't have the actual communication engines up and running. When I say engines, this is the ability to get the correct words, or the best words, and structures. So that's just not there yet. And also that's the small level problems. The larger level problems is that there's this basic thing in that there is, the intelligence hasn't been destroyed, it's still there, and it's probably running amok. It's a lovely scene, this lovely duck just sitting on the road here as I'm driving home. Okay, this and gratitude. I was speaking with some people behind the desk of this institute, which I'm picking up a certificate for, and we just had a talk about positive stuff, positive attitudes and being happy, and that they were seemed a relatively happy together bunch, as opposed to a lot of people I see who are just continuously angry. You know, it's all high tension. It's not a happy place. And so these people seem happy. And they related to me the story of someone on the ABC News who goes to do some aid work with people up in India, remote, very poor India. And a clip of them talking about gratitude and gratitude in these very poor areas of India. And because they don't have full English, when they're saying what I'm happy about, they say this sneakers, this book, this that. I'm really grateful for it. And this is and so he's going around the primary schools and introducing a new word in the Australian language to be dis about it. So you say, oh, dis. I'm dis about that. Dis that. It just means I'm grateful for that small thing. And as I say about it, there is a problem of getting everything you ever wanted is out of Willy Wonka type of stuff, is that people don't really calibrate themselves for, I suppose, what the story is death, limited resources and death, which is coming into. And then the problem is with, if you want everything, you just want more and more and more until eventually you get what is the always sequence of people, the idea of gold taps. You know, so Saddam Hussein had gold taps. It seems to be the thing that people tend to actually talk about, and that's value in things which are locked up in things which have intrinsically no value. So a bathroom tap has got a function, and if you make it gold, you're actually sucking out resources from someone else. And essentially, people their sense of satisfaction comes from not having but taking from other people and stuff like that. So you've got the idea of dis, and that simple cut through story. And there's sort of two bubbles of the grateful observers and souls who are just sort of become ungrounded but grounded, a combination of, and the people who are grounded in the real world and who are grabbing resources, controlling resources, and because they are slaves for resources, they're actually quite good at making something happen, because they've actually got an emotional commitment to the real world, which is basically what you want. You want someone driving a truck, as I see up ahead, to have an emotional attachment to making money and delivering something. So you want them to real world. The problem is that person, to interact with them, will have other people who are also grounded, and eventually you lose gratitude, you lose your ability to be ethereal and happy by yourself. And this is the price I think we're paying of this enormously industrial society. Now, the great thing is that as technology has got us off the land and off out of the paddock and huddled against TV sets, now technology is saying we no longer need you in the factories. And so a certain amount of things is that we used to be doing a lot of manual work, which stopped us being absolute assholes to each other. Now we're reducing we're automating work, which is allowing assholeness to flourish as never before. Now, hopefully, this is a short-term thing. So I instantly had a rapport with these people who just said my son, who I'm doing it, would be mortified because I've got a strict do not interact ban with. And of course, what's worse is that I'm actually interacting with the whole world by podcasting about this type of stuff. So I quickly said, look, I do have a story, and I do have this sort of mechanical thing is do not speak about yourself, try and speak about some other things, but essentially if you speak about other things, people go, what? So you need just a little tiny hook into yourself. So I said, oh, look, I was in this having heart operations, and one of the things that I noted is a number of people who they've just saved their lives and they wake up angry, wanting to tear shreds off people. And then there was two sort of bubbles. There was the nurses who sort of built a bubble around those, and myself, who was with them, this all, wow, happiness, happy, we're alive, whoa. I don't know who's paying for it or what's going on, but wow, there's great drugs and all this type of stuff, all this positive happiness, and that this bubble that people go into, and they noted that that's perhaps why they had the heart attack. To a certain extent, it is true, but you're going to die anyway, and I think heart disease, you're going to catch cancer and stuff, and there'll be some sort of stuff which you wind out, and essentially, I think, look, to be quite honest, I think people die spiritually years and years before they actually physically die, and so when they do that, they're sort of like space zombies taking up space in society. Now, what's really sad is to see young children where the actual soul has gone, and it's sort of this touchstone where they are. Part of a child is to wake up into the universe and think, and to say, what's this? This is me. And to have to look at yourself a bit. And looking at yourself is not at all bad. Because one of the things you have to really understand is who you are and what you look like and how you are seen, possibly to make out the world as all these other people suddenly responding to you. So you've got to have a sense of self. This is great, but there's this critical thing about where the looking at yourself becomes actually a prison, and you become imprisoned in your own image, and you can see that happening, and that your escape routes go the moment that you start to say, I like that person bullying the other person, I like a power structure. That liking is also permission for you to remain encapsulated in your own self-image. And you, of course, you can't get down and say, look, wake up to yourself. They either have it or, I don't know, either have it or they don't. Now, I suppose the curious thing for me is I have actually never seen, I don't know whether it's a physical law that after a certain time, when people cross the Rubicon, if you can say, so let's talk about the Rubicon. Rubicon is a fairly insignificant creek. Okay, it's not a major river, it's a creek which you can ride across, apparently so, in the Apennines. And they sort of, and Caesar was in a military state, in a military violent state. Caesar was incredibly military and incredibly violent, and was a success in the Roman model of things. But the Roman model of things, which is this macho, testosterone-charged, women-hating, stupid state, if I can say so. Look, I know a lot of people say, oh, the Romans are smart, and they just file through the files, and, oh, they're smart doing this. Really, they are pretty ancient, dumb military state. But what they had is this structure, and that they said you can't cross the Rubicon. And so they had this state of slight connection to the Republic, slight thing into the old world, some sort of funny things, and then Caesar, and they said, look, you can do whatever you want, but we're going to draw a barrier, which is the Rubicon. You can't cross this river. And so Caesar's there, and he's been given a license to be Caesar, to actually put Rome, to extend the Rome experiment of a slightly more advanced technology bashing up lower advanced technology. And this is what we see at the moment, the US bashing up lower, less advanced civilizations, and seeing that as somehow proof that they are the better civilization. And they're just more technically advanced, richer. Okay, oops. Richer and stuff like that. So it's this type of stuff. So, and of course, this sort of power, success breeds. People don't say success is just what it is, and it doesn't give me a license to do that next thing. In fact, that's what entire society is. It's a narrative which you want to build your story so you can do the next act. Now, but taken out of context, that next act should really stand on itself and be logical. But no, it's not. People justify the act as a story all the way through. So with this, is you've got a toxic, highly combustible combination of power and ignorance, to quote Carl Sagan. And so you've got this sort of two-level stable system of the world divided in two places. One is Caesar's world north of the Rubicon, and the old world, which could potentially go in a different direction, south of the Rubicon. And at a certain point in time, people, or Caesar, crossed the Rubicon. They thought they had, there's pictures of him thinking about this great moment in history. In fact, it probably is perhaps whether it happened or not, is perhaps it's perhaps a really great moment in history. Because what happened is that then this took over the agenda of the old world and destroyed it and replaced it with something which undoubtedly plunged us into the Dark Ages. There was not the elements of... the ancient world really couldn't generate its next step. The ancient world had actually run its course. It had a great system when it had a naval... It was a naval or sea-based thing. It's sort of like a mole growing on the inside of a Petri... on the rim of a Petri dish. It was a rim culture under the Greeks. And this process meant that there was thinking time between every step, because if you had a bit of action, your resources would run out, then you'd have to get on a ship, and then you have to... there'd be all these steps that were required to do. Of course, then the Romans built roads and infrastructure and actually accelerated the ancient world to an ancient logical conclusion of crucifixion, power, hate, and stuff like that. If you actually look at it, you had sort of some of the high ideals, some of the let's try and think our way out of it, to actually thinking not being a resource, or thinking actually not being valued for thinking only being valued as a resource. So the Romans used thinking purely as a weapon as well, so weaponizing it. And so this is essentially what kids and everyone tends to do, is that they cross the Rubicon and destroy forever this a system of innocence and joy that they can have by actually stepping out themselves, by having a little bit of forgiveness and all that type of stuff. And for me, I've got that model. The big question is, for someone who's not crossing that Rubicon, well, I can... Yeah, I think what people physically... I think the real issue is that people... I know this is a bit hard to get, so we're talking about this and gratitude, but that's not the major issue for me. It's whether people have to actually physically go through a series of actions which have thinking historical accounting significance. So it's whether you must honor every anniversary, you must do everything the same, sort of buy into a significance which reduces the actual significance. So they have a ceremony is supposed to, like a birthday or something like that, is supposed to actually mark the significance of something. However, what actually happens is that the thing that is supposed to mark the significance of a deeper thing becomes the most significant thing. And when you model like that, once you transform, if you like, my actual value to not your physical value but your accounting value, you lock things in. You can actually go bankrupt quite easily. Things become intrinsically unstable. So we're going to talk about this. So you have a birthday. Now, a birthday is to celebrate a person and acknowledge them and stuff like that. It's about the person, about the structure, about the future. It's about the relationships. It's about everything like that. It's not about the cake or the presents or even the observance of the actual date. Things which are really necessary for the ceremony to happen. And at a certain point, the ceremony becomes all important. And so the ceremony actually overtakes the significance of what the actual thing is. So, this is sort of really strange. It's very much what society is. Our society is about certification of the skill. And people are very interested because the skill has a certain risk associated with it. So if I do heart surgeries and stuff like that, 1 in 100 people are going to die. Where it matters is that we go, oh, 1 in 100 people die. Is the person certified? Oh, they are. Oh, let's move on. It's sort of that certification is a permission for society not to think. And really, a lot of ceremonies are a certification of a something deeper, and it's a permission for people not to actually engage with the actual critical thing. Now, if they don't engage with the critical thing, they become forever a prisoner of ceremonies, beliefs, actions. If they cross the Rubicon, they can't cross back. So now, of course, what I want to do is actually mount a series of daring trans-Rubicon raids to whether I can actually rescue. The idea is that I'm actually the person who's lost. I'm lost to the actual economy of meaningless ceremonies. Now, I know this is a very, very daring, controversial thing. Perhaps I'm not the person who has to be rescued. Perhaps it's everybody else who has to be rescued from meaninglessness to meaning. And you can't, if you've lost the thread, if you haven't watched the whole movie through on meaning, it's sort of like trying to pick up the meaning and the thread of a movie by coming in halfway through and saying, oh, well, what's happened? Oh, well, the hero's done this. This is the actual thing. Oh, and they listen to it and they go, gee, this doesn't really work for me. Well, because they haven't been in the situation to actually pick up the meaning. So there's this aspect of it. And so there are these things. I really don't quite understand how it actually operates in terms of you encounter these things. There's a few signature things which are wrong. Now, that is, a few facts are wrong, a few things are recalled incorrectly, and there's sort of this sort of overall overpowering view to say, let's go with the incorrect thing. And there's a sort of a statute of limitations that if I can keep something incorrect for long enough, it'll be correct. It'll be deemed correct. Well, yeah, it may work in this trans-Rubicon sort of testosterone-charged state where you can actually slaughter a village and then after a while build a triumphal arch to it and go, ho-ho, look everybody, here's this treasure. Now, the treasure, you know, you focus people on the treasure and not the actual bloody villages and all the things. And the idea of after a time you write history. But the entire idea is that when you write a history, you're actually building a prison for the people of the future to actually work out that, what's this? This is not. Oh, it's a prison. It's actually a prison constructed for my behaviour to go within certain lines, get me boundary. You know, this. What's this here? It seems it's a ravine which I can only get to my vital supplies via this ravine, which has been well trodden. Everyone understands that if you want to go the other way, you can become a traffic hazard for them all. So that's rather an interesting, I suppose aspect. So let's get back to it. You've got the the idea that these people have should I call the Romans dumb? They definitely weren't. They didn't have maths. They didn't have high-level philosophy. They had sort of rhetorics of the ancient precursors to what we would call logic and stuff like that. And in your Iron Age world, there wasn't writing. There wasn't institutions. There's just violence. So people could gather around as a tribe and attack and destroy. It was sort of like a Game of Thrones era. And this is, I think, what people love about Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones actually relates to how people live now. There is superstition. There's this awe of politics. Stupidity has its own glow about it, and this feeling that somehow magic actually does work. Somehow I heard of someone being happy, so that's what happiness is. This is I'm not happy myself. I can never eat enough ice cream to be really happy. In fact, I get, as would be normal, the first lick of ice cream is great, and the rest of the ice cream is sheer profit to the ice cream company. That type of stuff. It really is the aim for human happiness. In fact, is every day to be completely different from the day before, to be completely engaging and stuff. Although people really get quite angry. They say, this is not what just happened yesterday. This is this is not what's happened yesterday. I am addicted to more. More is such an addictive thing because it's got so much wanting. So sort of like Madame Monsieur, what would you like with your you stick down, would you like pommes frites or something like that? No, I like more steak Diane. Okay, here's a bigger steak Diane. Are you happy? Are you happy with it? No. What would you like? I want a bigger one. And so eventually people get these huge, big, lopsided steak Dianes, and they've got to eat their way through it, which is quite a challenge. So eventually these people buy these huge, huge homes which kill all the nature around them. It means there's no blocks, and there's this sort of shoulder shrug saying, what's happened to society? Well, the actual society's actually built these big blocks, and those big blocks, big huge houses which take a lot to eat through, is something that you've really paid for, but it's a lot of pretty much the same thing. So I've got a room, I'm quite happy with it, I want a second room. Now, of course, you're only one person, you can't sit in more than one room. So you've got these huge houses, stuff, and of course, there is actually no time for gratitude, no time for thought. You are doing it, and there's this satisfaction, this angst about what do you really want? I just want some more. And when you are being grateful, you're not demanding. It's this is whole thing. And so it's one of the things, imagine if if gratitude caught hold in modern capitalism. That is where people didn't rush through the supermarket, but actually considered a few items, were grateful for it, had a huge long conversation. The economy would grind to a halt overnight. The entire thing about world GDP expanding at such a huge rate is that, well, thank goodness it's mostly going to middle class, you know, sort of the really poorest of the poor, moving up just a little bit, just to do the, I forgot his name, Hans and Roland Awesome, I've forgotten what his name, from the Gapminder Institute. That is happening. However, what's really driving things is what we really can't, we sort of, it's your badge of economic credibility, is that if you cater for the mythical American in the Midwest who's got insatiable, irrational demand, and essentially when you've got what you think is a stupid product that no one quite needs, it's probably ripe for an American to buy outright. And so, yeah, I think perhaps the worst thing I've ever seen, the worst success I've ever seen, is your startup visionary who really doesn't have enough life experience not to make a phony promise, and they make a small profit. As look, it's really hard to make a profit from startups in Australia because there's just no market, no money, no infrastructure, stuff like that. But they do make a small profit built on the shattered dreams of their employees. It's basically, if you could actually do proper accounting, if you could properly account for false and fake promises and beliefs. Now this unfortunately, is the fact is that a startup is, from many, many angles, fake, ill-considered fake promises and stuff like that. It's just that you align people who believe the fake promises downstream, which is employees, and upstream with your backers, and perhaps you might go there. But there's often very little. The actual key ingredient to actually make it successful is missing, and essentially a few people learn what the key ingredient is, and eventually over a long time they strike it lucky. And of course what happens is that they when they struck it lucky, they blow up as big balloons, success balloons, and the only way that they can do is they propagate this startup stuff. So it's hard to say in terms of, for me, the startup is this. It seems very positive, and it seems better than the grim hate which runs a lot of society. But it's sort of like pseudo stuff. I suppose what's really interesting is that the whole aspect of companies is, so the whole company gets resources that will be able to, they're grateful, they're showing a gratitude. A company will show gratitude for a future situation for which it can profit from. And so their gratitude means that they will give resources ahead of time, ahead of the actual production. Now, this means that they give resources two things. One is to sustain production as it is and produce their profit. And they reserve a small amount of that to actually give to things which don't produce profit at the start and go forward. So this is sort of like, you've got to have some sort of sense of gratitude to actually leverage this next step up. But it's sort of a very, I suppose, insane way to go. Well, look, basically, yeah, there's a whole heap of really sensible reasons for economic advancement, technological advantage advancement, because on one aspect, we're building drugs, things which are really improving life, and we can actually build a more fuel-efficient car, right? Or that's one example. However, in the building of that more fuel-efficient car, we've actually built up whole junkyards, whole huge areas of less efficient cars which have wrecked the environment in the process of getting them. Whereas the best thing we could possibly have done is actually tone down the car manufacturing and actually seeing if we could actually really calculate our way through to the most fuel efficient car. So we could actually get to the same end point with a whole lot less waste. Now what's happening is that we're beginning to get the circular economy. So what happens in Australia, at least, we have all these robotic railways just exporting huge, not a person, robotic trucks, robotic trains, robotic ports. There might be one or two people seeing billions of dollars worth of ore going up to China. And what happens is at a certain point in time, the laser surveys of the tracks say these tracks are running out, because these tracks run out a lot because they've got maximum load. And what happens is that they get retracked at so many kilometers an hour. Literally retracked at so many kilometers an hour. Robots put in the new tracks. The other tracks go up, and then they go into a shredder, and they get shredded and remelted. Isn't that incredible? So you've got that type of technology at the end. But what it's doing? It's actually going into an inefficient iron smelter in China, which is belching out carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So I don't know, it's just in terms of human happiness, we attend our technology, yes, if you actually look at it, is delivering happiness at the end, and it is certainly a lot more efficient than what was happening before. It's just that we could possibly get there with a whole lot less angst. So I've got two views. One is getting there with a whole lot less angst, that's what we're going to try and do. The second aspect is there any way to run sort of a American-style hostage rescue mission to actually get some of these people back across the brink and re-educate them? So not like a Uyghur re-education camp, but re-educate them in humanity to see if we can actually do that. Now, they are obviously repeating ad nauseum the behaviour that they're locked into because they know no different. And so the thing is, they don't have the formula at hand to change their behaviour. It may be like a fundamental algorithm that this means that you can't do anything else to help them. They're gone. But I don't think that's what we're definitely about. We don't say if we've got a sick person in hospital, we try and figure out see if we can actually. The actual principle of the thing is not whether we can do it; it's the principle of wanting to do it. So essentially, if you're a doctor in a hospital and you might be able to cure the person, but if you want to cure the person, that really changes the entire dynamic. So, yeah, so for me, I can see the whole world's not against me, but the whole world's actually against itself. And just trying to work out. So these guys here working away, you poor bastards. Hopefully I'll get home. We'll see what's going there. Yeah, so look, there is a perhaps thing. I didn't think I'd be able to talk for so long, but the entire idea of gratitude. Gratitude is toxin to the capitalist system. The capitalist system works on two aspects. One, a lack of gratitude. Rather than gratitude, you need expectation. Expectation is known as a demand. It also has a system. It's like a two-level system. One is that gratitude can't exist. The second law of capitalism is that people can't learn to be grateful. The last thing you want to do is you don't want someone to want be grateful. You want them to be... The only way people can show their real gratitude in capitalism is wanting more. And the way that they can control things, that they can want more, and they can complain and do it. So there's two aspects. That is the behaviour and the actual mindset, which locks people in and traps them in that behaviour. Thanks a lot for listening. I think this might be a bit wanky, but it's a bit of a try anyway.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.